You're listening to Real Talk, sponsored by Marcus Werenberg Theaters. I'm Colin Ritter.
And I'm Pierre Lewis.
And in today's episode, we are going to be talking about our top 10 favorite movies of all time.
Our personal top 10 as of Tuesday, May 16, 2017, at just about 1 p.m.
Exactly, because odds are by the time that this episode airs and by the time that you hear it, our top 10s will have changed just a little bit.
Fun fact, this is an episode we've attempted to make about three times now.
Yeah.
And
we're never satisfied. It's like it always changes.
This will be the definitive edition that we're fine with going out to the air.
Exactly. And you know what? Maybe, say, 6 months down the road, we will redo the top 10 episode to see if it's changed, which I can guarantee you it has. But I think it's safe to say the changes that are made are relatively similar. We have this bank of our favorite movies, and they just seem to kind of always bounce around, you know? So I guess to kind of get things started, we're going to talk about the best of the rest. So some of our favorite movies of all time that didn't make our top 10 list.
I at least put a lot of thought into, you know, do I want this to be somewhere? I imagine you have as well.
Exactly, yeah. So do you want to start us off there with some of your best of the rest films?
Absolutely. Won't dwell on most of these because I think we've talked about most of these. But the first one I could think of was Close Encounters of the Third Kind.
Yeah, of course.
Love it as a science fiction movie. I love it as a drama. I had American Graffiti from my boy George Lucas.
Classic.
Good film. I also have, believe it or not, Empire Strikes Back did not make the list for me.
Wow.
And it seems like every time I do a top 10 favorite films, any of the Star Wars original trilogies just never find a way in.
That's because
I don't know why. You secretly hate
Star Wars,
I
Peter.
Do. We've
established this.
Star Wars is stupid.
You can't say that on this show.
I also have Donnie Darko.
Oh, gosh.
It's so weird. I just loved it the first time I ever watched it.
Fair enough.
Almost Famous from Cameron Crowe.
Okay.
If you've never seen, just a beautiful movie. RoboCop.
We know how you feel about RoboCop.
It is genius.
For those of you who didn't hear the episode, I believe it was the 80s episode, 80s. Peter thinks RoboCop should have won Best Picture.
It is the greatest movie ever made.
We're just going to leave it right there.
I also have American History X.
Okay.
Just an interesting all-around movie. Fight Club. I mean,
okay.
Fantastic movie. Dr. Strangelove from my favorite director, Stanley Kubrick.
Yeah.
He's got only one film, surprisingly, on my top 10, but
it is surprising.
It is number one. And I also have Fargo and Rocky.
Fair enough.
Rocky almost made it, honestly, but just not enough.
Just in case anyone was wondering, if you need a copy of Rocky, Peter has copies of Rocky for days. Yep. He's just handing them out to everybody.
Don't know how it happened. I just do.
He just accidentally buys multiple copies and then just gives them away. He's nice like that.
That's charity.
Right?
That's how charity works.
Some of my best of the rest films include Psycho from the master of suspense himself, Alfred Hitchcock. I'm a fan of all of his films. And, you know, I could say that a large majority of the movies he made are going to be in my best of the rest because I just think what he did, the artistry expressed in his movies is honestly unmatched. Even today, I don't think there's a director who's ever been able to master suspense the way that Alfred Hitchcock did. And I mean, that's just simply why he has to be on the best of the rest.
If you love film as an art, like it's hard to not like Alfred Hitchcock.
Yeah, it's hard to not mention him. I have Singing in the Rain from 1952 on my best of the rest. I have Spirited Away, the animated film from Hayao Miyazaki. I also have Star Wars on my best of the rest. Believe it or not, Star Wars is not in my top 10 as of right now. And then a very, very recent film, one that I think will go down as one of the best films ever made, La La Land, is also in my best of the rest. It's not in my top 10, but it is in my best of the rest.
Fair enough, right?
Yeah.
Basically.
So I think we can actually go ahead and get started and kind of delve into this top 10. So Peter, do you want to start us out with your number 10 favorite movie of all time?
From 1994, from Kevin Smith, Clerks.
Why am I not surprised, Peter?
I always open number 10 with this spot. And I think it's for the reason that it's just so interesting.
Yeah.
I know it's easy to say about, you know, your favorite movies. I mean, it's almost cliche, but I think when it comes down to what Kevin Smith did with Clerks, it's just so interesting how he really didn't have any story for the most part.
Yeah.
But he had a film just solely focused on characters and just the idea of, you know, just the routine, mundane work of, you know, part-time work. That always interested me.
And admittedly, I think we've talked about this before, I've actually not seen Clerks, believe it or not. So that's something I definitely need to watch.
This is probably the best age to see it because you'll understand it more.
Yeah, exactly.
I feel like if you wait till 30s, you're probably like, this is the dumbest thing ever. And in some ways, it kind of is, but in a lot of ways, that's why it's so good. I would argue that there's really nothing going on. It, it's almost like Seinfeld the movie. It's just, you know, it's a movie about nothing. But again, there is something, of course, going on. But again, you're here for just these ridiculous characters, these just pits of just great dialogue, and just the interesting atmosphere this film creates.
It should also be noted that one of Peter's other favorite films is the 2003 film The Room, one of his favorites of all time.
Oh, yeah, put down the best of the rest. How can I forget about that masterpiece?
How can you forget about that masterpiece? That's right.
Mr. Colin, what is your number 10?
My number 10 is from my boy. My number 10 list, let me just preface by saying this, is probably the most cliche list of top 10 favorite movies of all time. But I'm a diehard 70s and 80s geek. I love the filmmaking style, as we've discussed in our past episodes about the decades from our decade series. But my number 10 is the 1993 movie Jurassic Park.
Fair enough.
Yeah, it's so much fun. It's an adventure. It's everything I love about movies. It's everything I love about good storytelling. It's an adventure from beginning to end. You fall in love with the characters. You have great development. Technologically speaking, it's incredible. It's an incredible film, and it was the first of its kind to use such complex computer-generated imagery. And I think it honestly set a standard for the industry with regard to computer-generated imagery, because there are movies made now that have CGI that's honestly worse than what we saw in Jurassic Park. I mean, Jurassic Park was well before its time.
It holds up till today. And again, they haven't really made many edits to it or alterations.
Exactly.
It's what you're seeing was what the audiences saw in 1993, I believe, when it came out.
Yeah.
Which I think is impressive. But again, from a storytelling standpoint, character standpoint, script standpoint, it's a solid film.
It is. I mean, obviously developed from the book. You have an incredible creative team, as mentioned, my boy Steven Spielberg, which you will be hearing his name a lot throughout this episode. But yeah, I mean, just it's a great movie, and I feel like it's a movie everyone has watched before in the past. And yeah, it's one of those that's kind of always in my top 10, and if it ever leaves my top 10, it comes right back. You know, it's kind of one of those things, which I assume you can kind of agree with Clerks. It's one of those things you feel like you have to have it on there.
Oh, yeah. And again, it fills the Jeff Goldblum's quota for this
exactly.
list. So, you know, that's
you got to have that filled. So, yeah, we start off right with that. So, moving on to number 9 for you, Peter. What do you have as number 9?
The second most recent film on my list that came out 2008, The Dark Knight.
The Dark Knight. So, now you can't give me any crap for having La La Land on my best of the rest list, because you also have a newer movie. But anyways, Dark Knight, great movie.
I almost put Mad Max Fury Road on this list.
Oh my gosh.
It is genius, Colin. We'll get to that later. But The Dark Knight, just, you know, coming off Batman Begins, which was just so interesting.
Yeah.
In how they played with, you know, the comic book movie.
Mm-hmm.
But again, they made it more of a graphic novel, which I thought would, you know, never be able to do on the big screen. That's just a challenge to get that tone believable with, you know, the idea of someone dressing up as a bat fighting,
yeah,
you know, a clown.
Yeah.
But that's what this film does.
It does that, exactly. And it's terrifying in its own way while it does it. We've talked about this briefly. I believe when we were talking about, gosh, I forget what episode it was. It might have been trailer talk when we were talking about Justice League.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of the existence of the DC universe and how all of them are kind of clinging to this idea of making dark films and kind of running with that. I think The Dark Knight does it better. It kind of set it into motion, really, but I think it does it better than any other superhero movie ever made, because it's terrifying and kind of scary and an adventure at the same time.
I mean, a large portion of that is Heath Ledger's role as the Joker.
Of course.
You also have Chris Nolan, who I get some people who are mixed on him as a mm-hmm. director. I understand that point, but I think you can't argue that this is the film where he got it right.
Oh, without
Just
a doubt.
Honestly, there's the scumbag cynic in me who's always wanting to find something wrong with something. I personally just cannot see anything. And, you know, even people bring up, you know, point, I'm just like, sorry, I can't see that point. I just don't think there's anything wrong with this film.
You know, I'm actually going to have to agree with you there. I mean, superhero movies are hard to get right.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's because we're seemingly desensitized to superhero movies because we see them so often. So when you see a bad one, it's kind of, yeah, you don't really think about it. But when you see a great one, it's like, oh my gosh, did you see it? And I feel like that's kind of how it is with The Dark Knight. I mean, you're right. I mean, it's beautifully done. Probably one of the best, obviously Batman's a story that's been retold and retold, you know, over time. But I think it's one of the best developmental, you know, narratives ever used for the story of Batman and how it came to be.
The thing about comic book movies and just superhero movies in general is, you know, they try to make this, you know, world they're in believable. Like, this man actually exists. And it's hard to do that. Like,
yeah.
If you see Man of Steel, I mean,
oh,
it's understandable. But at the same time, it's like, this is not what a Superman film should be. This is exactly what a Batman film
Absolutely.
Should be if it's based in reality.
Exactly. It's gritty. It's raw. And it's fun. I mean, I say that about every single movie that I like, but it's fun.
And the reason I put everything on my list is there for a reason, because of watchability. Like, if you said, Peter, you want to watch The Dark Knight right now? Absolutely. I could watch that probably 5 times in a row and not get sick of it, because I think, you know, the script is just incredible. I love the direction. I love the tone, the lighting. It's just all around, it did everything for me. And that, I think that's probably the thing what pushed me from originally I wanted to go into sports journalism. I think I saw this film in 2008. I was like, you know what? Film journalism would be fun.
Yeah.
Because I had just so much to say about it, and I didn't even realize, you know, like, wow.
You didn't know there was this outlet to kind
exactly.
of express yourself.
And
I
saw, I was like, this is, I have to say, as far as films have come out when I was alive that I can remember, this and Mad Max Fury Road kind of changed how I look at film.
Yeah, no doubt. This is one, I think I saw this movie like 3 times in the theater. And it's one of those, kind of like you said, you can always go back to. And that's kind of how I shape my list, too, and what weans out certain movies from being on my top 10? What movies can I always come back to and watch at any given time?
I'm almost amazed I put this at number 9.
I am too,
now
to be honest.
Now I'm worried. Like, did I oversell the movie too much? Probably did, but you know what, Colin?
We shall see.
We'll just put that in the back burner. You're number 9.
My number 9 is, some people will probably laugh at my number 9. But our last Disney episode, I briefly talked about this movie. But my number 9 is the 1988 movie, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? I think it's one of the most fun movies there is. It's a movie that I can almost always come back to and watch it. If I'm not totally just into the movie, I can have it playing in the background. And, it's a movie that you can kind of tune in at any time and then find enjoyable. As mentioned in a previous episode, it's the perfect blending of live-action filmmaking and animated filmmaking. Because anyone who knows me knows I love animation. I love animation so much. And the story is so much fun, and that combination works so well. And I think something else that works so well with this film, the different IPs that they have for this film. We have some of the biggest cartoon universes in the world. I mean, that's sounds very cliche.
Yeah.
Working together, and, you know, all together in this one movie. I mean, we have Looney Tunes, and we have Disney all together, and it's so much fun. It's a riot. I mean, and the jokes, they're over the top. They're physical. But it's fun. Gosh, I can always come back to this movie.
I think the best thing about that film is that you can tell when someone's having fun working on a film from how it's presented.
Yeah.
Oh, you can tell everybody involved in that film was having a blast.
Oh, yeah.
Just the idea of, like, the challenge, you know. Again, like we said in a past episode on Disney, you know, doing live action and animated work side by side has been done since the 30s, correct?
Yeah.
But again, for the
80s,
Well, you know,
I guess technically it's been... You know, with the Alice comedies, we're talking the 20s with the Disney studios.
But again, you think on just this scale, I mean, a full-fledged movie, you know, over 90 minutes, I mean, that's a challenge. And to make it not only be believable, but I think the most impressive thing that I just, you know, thought of, you know, you have all these classic characters that you love, but you introduce this new character called Roger Rabbit.
Yeah.
And you honestly like him more, and when you see Bugs Bunny and Mickey Mouse.
I know,
isn't
it crazy?
It's like, that's cool. Go back to Roger.
Exactly.
That's a cool thing to do.
It is. And the blending, the way that these animated characters exist in this world it's flawless. I mean, something as small as the way shadows are projected onto walls and onto the floor. I look at those little things because, as mentioned, I'm like a total animation geek, and I love seeing the flaws and the mistakes in animation, like little bitty things like in a film I'll talk about later, like when you can see little, I don't want to say errors, but I think it adds a little touch of brilliance when you can see the fact that it's hand-drawn. And I think it does it so well in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. You can see the fact that it's hand-drawn and the love and the sweat and tears that go into developing an animated movie. And then that blend with this comedy that's sort of a drama, but it doesn't really know what it is, and just throw that together, and it is such a fun movie, and it's one that I can always come back to.
And it manages a sensory overload very well.
Absolutely.
I mean, when they go to Toontown, I mean, the amount of Easter eggs and detail and just whole sequence is phenomenal.
And it's so much fun. That's always been my favorite scene in the movie, you know, when he goes into Toontown, and it's just over the top, and it's in your face. It's just a blast.
And Eddie's just a fun character all
around. Exactly. You're right. Well, let's move on here to your I guess we're at number seven. No, eight. Sorry, we're on number eight. Peter, what is your number eight? And who directed your number
eight? Well, the man who directed is, I'd consider him more of a god.
Oh my gosh, don't even. Don't even go there.
Quentin Tarantino's 2009 Inglourious Basterds.
Oh my gosh.
I know you don't like him.
No, it's not that I don't like him. I just think he's overhyped.
I'll kind of give you that in some respect. I honestly will.
Good movie, though. No doubt. Good movie.
I will say, I just thinking about his film, his films, Pulp Fiction, Django Unchained. I mean, he has great films that I've loved, but I think what made this work for me was, I know you'll probably disagree, I think it was his most mature. I know it's hard to say when, you know, you the way he kills Hitler in this movie and just how the bastards work.
Yeah.
But I think just the idea to play with alternative history in a drama. Like that's
a fun concept. It really is. It's a very interesting concept.
Cause especially in film, like alternative history is kind of a hard thing to do.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, it's always centers around Nazis because that's kind of how the genre began in many regards. But to do it in such a mature and smart way, that's something I think he doesn't get enough credit for this film.
I can agree with that.
Everyone's always like, oh, Pulp Fiction is his masterpiece. Like, I can't help but, you know, I agree with that. But I think what he did here with just these characters and just like this script, I mean, that's always been my favorite thing about Tarantino is I love his scripts. No matter what the film is, even if I'm not too crazy about it, which there are some Tarantino films I'm not fully into.
Fair enough.
I think that's what his strongest suit is.
Yeah.
And I just respected him so much, you know, try something like this. It's so weird, but pull it off so well.
You know, I'll agree. And I will say, it's not that I hate Quentin Tarantino. It's not that I hate him. I mean, let me go on the record and say that. I don't hate him as a director. He's not my favorite. But I will say, I actually do really enjoy this movie. The one thing, and feel free to criticize Spielberg all you want when I mention my next movies, because I get it. Spielberg's probably one of the most cliche directors and producers in Hollywood. I get it. But it's like these fast cuts, just these hard, fast edits. And I'm always like, it's a perfect movie for someone who doesn't have a good attention span because it just happens. So much is thrown right in your face that it kind of disorients you. But, I mean, I get it. Now, with this film, I won't say that's necessarily the case because I actually do enjoy this.
Well, that's the style that kind of works for me in his movies. Just, you know, his problem is what I have with a famous video game maker called Hideo Kojima.
Okay.
He kind of just doesn't, he has to pull himself back at some points and he doesn't.
Yeah.
But I think in this film, he's at this perfect balance of knows when to do this, not to do that, and keep moving forward.
And just go full force.
And again, like I said, great characters. Just probably his best and smartest story, I would say. I honestly would put up with their Pulp Fiction.
Wonder what he'd be like to hang out with in person.
Be weird.
I wonder if he'd be weird, if he'd be like very stoic and just not say much.
I feel like a mix from what I've seen.
He kind of like expresses himself in his movies.
Like, I would love him on
this
show.
He has a lot of built up energy and he just lets it out. He's like, let's edit here, cut here, cut here. Anyways, but yeah. Yeah, I'll agree with it. That's a good, obviously not on my top 10, but that's a good pick. You know, one of the movies by Tarantino that I actually enjoy more than others.
Mr. Colin, what was your number eight?
My number eight is the 1996 film Toy Story. I mean, what can I say about Toy Story? I mean, I guess I should say, what can I say about Toy Story? This is the movie of my childhood. I bet you would agree it's the movie of your childhood as well. It's probably one of the most nostalgic, honestly, one of the most nostalgic movies I can think of. I mean, I remember watching this movie as a kid. Now, mind you, it came out in 96. I was born in 94, so I was, you know, too young to understand what was going on at this point. But watching it as I got older, it became so much a part of my childhood that by the time, like, Toy Story 3 came out, I mean, that's like an emotional roller coaster because, you know, the music, the characters, you truly fall in love with them. And this is something I think that Pixar Studios does better than anyone in the business. I think their character development is honestly the strongest of any studio. I truly stand by that.
On a consistent level.
Exactly.
They never seem to get, even when they have bad films like Cars 2.
Yeah.
I know it's a weird thing to mention on our top 10, but.
Yeah.
Even then, they still have characters that work.
Yeah.
And again, this is their first big film.
You're right. It shows. And that may be crazy for some to say. I mean, I know Disney owns Pixar, but being a Walt Disney Studios guy at heart, you know, having always been that way, I will say that I think Pixar does a better job at developing characters. And they have this great knack for developing inanimate objects and making you fall in love with them. I mean, something as simple and trivial as toys. I mean, toys that come to life. And you just fall in love with them. And the story's obviously great. It's a story that I think anyone who's from that era, who grew up as a kid in that time, can fall in love with and has fallen in love with, and even still now, at 22, I'm still in love with it. This is a movie I can always go back to, and I never get tired of.
I don't think it'll ever get old. And, you know, we reminiscing back to Jurassic Park, the technical aspect, I mean...
Oh, my gosh.
This is the first computer-generated animated movie on a big scale, and it looks so much better than some of this, you know, just...
It does. It really does.
Trash CGI animation that's being released today.
It does, and that's almost hard for me to say, because I am a die-hard hand-drawn animation fan, because, I mean, that to me, that's... Those are the fundamentals. Those are the principles of animation, how it started. I love the idea of having, you know, 30 frames per second, all drawn, transferred onto cells, inked. There's something so incredible about the men and women who develop those hand-drawn features.
You're going to love my number three, then.
I do love your number three, because I know what it is. But yeah, I think Toy Story, you're right. I mean, it was a great introduction to this idea and this... this introduction, really, you know, of 3D animation. I think it does it. Let me say it like this. I don't think it could have been done any better with regard to an introduction, an introductory sort of film. And obviously, I mean, the story goes without saying. It's great. It's a lot of fun. It's one of those you can always come back to.
It's always a feels trip when you watch it.
It really is.
Even though you've seen it multiple times.
Yeah.
I'm still like, yeah, this is a good, feel good movie.
It really is. Moving on, Peter, we are on number 7 right now. What is your number 7?
I had to have a crime film in here somehow because that's one of my favorite genres.
Fair enough.
And here's my thing. I love The Godfather, but I think it overly romanticizes the idea of, you know, the gangster lifestyle. That's what made it work. I love Scarface, obviously, because it's just in your face. It's stylistic and violent, of course. But the middle ground film that I always come back to is... from Martin Scorsese, a man I respect a lot. It's Goodfellas.
Yeah.
Just this perfect balance of just realistic depictions of what that lifestyle's like.
Yeah.
Based on a true story for the most part. And just some of the best characters I've seen. I mean, this fills my Joe Pesci quota.
You're right.
Actually, I want him on the show instead of Tarantino. No offense, but I would love just Joe Pesci swearing every 5 minutes about
something.
Just
come and sit down and talk to us. We're like, we just need him for 10 minutes.
But just in general, I mean, it's such a great film. And how it tells, you know, this story from, you know, start to beginning, basically over Henry Hill's whole life. That just amazes me how they were able to do that. And again, it's a fairly long film, but still, it's short in the span you would think a movie like that would need to tell this story. But it does. And I think it's just action-packed. It's suspenseful. It has great moments. And there's a good meaning to it in the end about, you know, this lifestyle.
You're right. I agree. I mean, I use this word a lot, but it's very raw. It's very gritty. And I know you have a deep respect for films like that, and I do too. And I think it's, as you said, it's a good depiction of what is oftentimes romanticized or over-dramatized. Mm-hmm. So I think you make a lot of good points there.
And some of those famous scenes, you know, especially when he's, you know, walking through the back of the kitchen, you know, you got the crystals, but it's like... It's just things like that that stick out. Like, it's such a random scene. It doesn't... I mean, I get there's people who make the argument it adds a lot to the movie, but for me, it's just like, it's just a nice little thing to show what this life is like.
Yeah.
And just, there's so much of that in this film. It's always a fun watch.
It, like, takes the most commonplace and the most uninteresting moments of life and makes them very interesting. It's kind of weird how it works, because you would think it wouldn't work, but it does work entirely well. And it's kind of entrances you in a sense.
Basically, like all these films I had on my list, just I think all around, it does a very solid job of what it's trying to do.
Yeah.
Mr. Colin, you're number 7.
My number 7, we're going to still hang tight on the cliche express here, and we're going to move over to the 1971 film, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Good film.
Great movie, great music. Gene Wilder, need I say more? Gosh, I love Gene Wilder. Admittedly, I had like an obsession with this movie as a kid. Like, I went through this weird phase where I was like, maybe I'm going to be a chocolate maker. I mean, that's completely ridiculous to think about, but such a fun movie. I mean, and thinking back, you know, later down the list, I'll kind of further explain the reasons why I love film and why I even went into the performing arts for many years, you know, the films that inspired that and the music that inspired that. But this Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory was definitely one of those films for me. I think this is the quintessential, you know, idea of escapism and adventure. To think that anyone and everyone can get chosen to go on this quote-unquote magical adventure through this chocolate factory that is larger than life. I mean, this candy factory that's larger than life. And you follow the lives of these characters whom you fall in love, well, some you fall in love with and some you hate, but that's the intent, of course. And Gene Wilder's character is probably one of the most interesting... I love Gene Wilder. I mean, and I love the work that he does with Mel Brooks. Young Frankenstein's another one of my best of the rest that I didn't mention, as well as Blazing Saddles. But that's beside the point. Gene Wilder's depiction, or the way he plays Willy Wonka in this film is incredible, because you don't know how to feel about the guy. Throughout the entire film, you don't know if you can trust him. You don't know if you should love him. You almost have like this very uneasy feeling the entire movie. And then at the very end, it's like the culmination of everything when, you know, Charlie comes back and here's the everlasting gobstopper. And he's like, you lose everything. And then it's incredible, because you never know. He keeps you on your toes. And I think it's a brilliant representation of Gene Wilder's talent.
I think just all this plays into, you know, getting tone and atmosphere just dead on of what you were trying to accomplish. Because, you know, a character like that, that's hard to do, especially for what's mostly a family film. Like, you know, you have an expectation of how this, you know, something like that's going to roll. But again, it's always keeping you on the edge of your seat, like what's going to happen next. And, you know, just the way they eliminate some of these kids is just so... It's iconic.
It's great. It really is. And
I love Charlie in this film, because, you know...
I agree.
I don't want to bring up the bad times of that certain bastardized remake, but where just Charlie's just so nice 100% of the time. Like, this Charlie, he can be selfish. He can be friendly. Like, that...
He gets it. He's a kid.
That's
exactly.
A kid. Exactly.
That's exactly right.
That's what a kid should be, especially in this situation, you know, coming from his background. It makes sense.
That, it does make sense.
And it's a rare thing to see nowadays, where you're like, oh, you know what? In retrospect, that all made
it
perfect.
Does.
It all fit together.
And back to Willy Wonka, that is a character that could very, very easily take a nosedive into bad territory. Mm-hmm. That character could have been portrayed very poorly and could have been obnoxious or could have been uninteresting. But as mentioned, I know I seem like I'm fangirling about Gene Wilder, and I am. But gosh, he does. I mean, such a brilliant job. And when he says, you know, we are the music makers. We are the dreamers of dreams. Oh my gosh, that gets you. If that doesn't give you goosebumps, I mean, give me a break.
What was great about him was he understood what character he was playing.
He did, yeah.
Like, he actually put effort into it. And again, just, you know, this great cast and crew around him. And it shows.
It does. It does show. But moving on from there, we're on to number six now. We're almost halfway there. It's crazy. Peter, what is your number six?
From 1951, The Day the Earth Stood Still. One of the earliest science fiction films I ever saw.
Yeah.
Probably the one that got me into science fiction. Honestly, more than Star Wars did.
What?
I think everyone sees Star Wars and like, oh, Star Wars is cool. But they might not be led to that path.
Yet another reason I say that Peter actually hates Star Wars and he's just trolling everyone. But anyways.
Star Wars is the stupidest thing ever made. It is for
exactly.
Children. It deserves to die.
That's awful, Peter.
Can't love Star Wars.
No, you don't.
But The Day the Earth Stood Still, just this... 1951, the idea to have commentary about, you know, the idea of atomic annihilation so early on in a film, that's crazy to me. And I mean, I just, the characters, just the design of the space, Gore is one of my favorite pop culture things of all time. I refuse to believe they remade this film. I saw it in theaters, but I refuse to acknowledge it exists.
You want to maintain its original, 1951 glory.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll just leave it at that, right?
And just, it takes you on this just weird adventure, but it's not really an adventure. It's just like this drama.
Yeah.
From start to finish, you know, just this UFO lands in Washington, D.C. They're guy's trying to make his point, and it's so weird. But it works.
Yeah.
I think that's probably the films I love the most. Like, it just sticks out, but they somehow get it right on.
I know, and you say it works, and I say that all the time, too, and that's so hard. I wish I could better explain that to the listeners. And I know that there are some listeners who just, they know what we mean. They know exactly what we mean. Because I know some movie buffs who do listen to our show, and when you say it works, they get it. But I wish we could, you know, articulate that a little more, because when you're a movie buff and when you say a movie works, that's the only thing you can say about it, because when it just works, it works. And it just sounds so cliche and redundant, but you're right. It just works.
That's all I really have to say. Until today, I hadn't thought about that for a long time, but just when I was making this list, I was like, you know what? That's a film I remember loving, and you know what? I got to put it in here somewhere, and I think, you know what? Number six, I'm fine with that.
And you know what? It works.
Absolutely. I think that's right.
Exactly.
What is your number six, Colin?
My number six is the 1953, so we're staying in the 50s. Mm-hmm. The 1953.
Didn't even plan on this.
Exactly, yeah. The 1953 animated classic, Peter Pan.
Mm-hmm.
Arguably my favorite animated Disney film of all time. No questions asked. I mean, honestly, I could say my favorite Disney film of all time without a doubt. I mean, obviously, it's the only... it's the highest, you know, ranked animated Disney film on my list. So definitely my favorite Disney film of all time. A movie that I loved as a kid so much. A movie that I still to this day know every single word. I can quote the entire movie from start to finish. Just an incredible journey. And we talked about this in our part one of our Disney series. Some of the biggest heavy hitters in Disney animation, you know, working on this film. I mean, just take back and look at, like, Ub Iwerks worked on this film. So Ub Iwerks was, you know, like, that was Walt Disney's right-hand man in the early days of the Disney studios. You know, he's the guy who animated Steamboat Willie. He's the guy who actually animated Mickey Mouse. You have Ken Anderson working on this film. You have Mary Blair. You have Claude Coates, Mark Davis. Some of the biggest names in Disney animation. Some of the biggest names in the Walt Disney Company as a whole. And just one of the most fun stories. And as I was alluding to earlier, you know, I love watching animated films and being able to see that human touch. And I think this is one of the best films for that, because I can distinctly remember watching one of the opening sequences from this movie when Miss Darling is shutting the window. And if you watch closely, you can see that it's almost kind of choppy as she's shutting the window. You can actually see the fact that it's drawn, and you can see that those frames are tied together and are sewn together. And when I can watch a movie and I can see those little bitty things, it just takes me into it so much more. And one of those things that's helped me develop my love for hand-drawn animation. And I think this movie expresses my love for that medium more than any other animated movie that there's ever been. I truly mean that. I think Peter Pan is one of the most beautiful animated feature films that's ever been drawn.
I don't think I will ever forget the art and style of that movie.
Oh my gosh.
The first time you see Peter Pan, Tinkerbell, it's just they're darkened out, but it looks
incredible. And that's people. It's almost easy to forget, but every scene that you see, that was done by a person. Mm-hmm. Like, men and women spent many, many hours and many tears and many, you know, many nights working on this movie. Every visual effect that you see is drawn, and that just blows my mind. You know, coming from a kid who I wanted to be an animator. I wanted to work for, you know, Walt Disney and Imagineering. I wanted to be an illustrator. And knowing what it takes to develop and draw some of those things, you know, I mean, I was admittedly a subpar, you know, drawer, but it's just incredible. And the artistry is just, it honestly can't be matched as far as I'm concerned.
And I just think a great story all around, fun characters. And, you know, the good thing about these classic Disney films, you know, they could tell these, you know, stories of films that, you know, anybody can get involved in, but they have the subtlety of, like, you know what, this world may not be so good when you think about it. Like, Neverland's kind of a crappy place when you really...
It's kind of messed up.
But, you know, at the same time, it's like, you get the appeal of it. But
yeah.
It makes both points. It doesn't make you feel, you know, like, you have to pick a side. It's like, here's both sides.
Yeah.
That's what we're picking.
We're just going to let it exist.
Exactly.
And, you know, Peter, kind of spawned, you know, a lot of other movies. Like, Hook is another one of my favorite movies, but I should put that on the best of the rest. But this kind of like Neverland, it's one of those places you really want to go. And as a kid watching this movie, gosh, I wanted to go to Neverland. But, you know, kind of like you said, it's kind of a scary place, but it's exciting at the same time. But yeah, just an all-star list of people working on this movie. Obviously, at this time, Walt was still alive, so he had his hand in this film. And it's one of my favorite Disney Parks attractions, too. So, I mean, there are a lot of reasons this is nostalgic and why I love it, and it just never gets old. But moving on, we're into number five now. We're officially halfway through the list. So, Peter, what is your number five favorite movie of all time?
This is the one when I told you just a while ago.
Oh my gosh.
Fairly shocked by it, but I will explain.
You're going to have to explain
my number five favorite film is a superhero movie, and you're like, whoa, didn't you already have The Dark Knight number 9? Like, there's one better. It's like, I kind of think so.
Oh, my
gosh. And that is Sam Raimi's 2004 Spider-Man 2.
Oh, my gosh, Peter.
Here's what...
This is when people say, oh, okay, I'm going to skip this podcast.
You have to understand 7-year-old Peter, who was into Spider-Man, Transformers, and Star Wars.
Fair enough. I get it.
When this came out, like, of course I loved it as a kid, but going back and rewatching it, here's the thing. Dark Knight is a great graphic novel.
Yeah.
Movie.
Mm-hmm.
Spider-Man is a fantastic Spider-Man 2 is a fantastic comic book movie.
I agree.
It gets the storytelling of what a comic is supposed to be. I mean, every fit, almost the cool thing in superhero movies, well, the cool thing to directors is, how do we make the point about, you know, this random person balancing their life and their superhero life?
Mm-hmm.
And they never seem to get it right. This is the film that just sticks out to me because it gets this relationship between Peter Parker being Peter Parker and Spider-Man just so perfect, showing, you know, the state of his life. Like, being a hero, again, with great power comes great responsibility. That responsibility is overtaking his personal life.
Yeah.
And just a fantastic villain. Doc Ock is probably the most developed villain I've seen past superhero movies outside of, you know, The Dark Knight. But again, that's kind of on a different pedestal than Spider-Man 2.
Yeah, I can agree with that, though.
And how it plays with the first movie. Because the first movie's kind of cheesy.
Mm-hmm.
It is cheesy, but that's why I love it. This matured very fast. Like, it didn't mess around. And it's just the power of, like, how Sam Raimi made some of these scenes. Like, you know, there's a point to, like, why you're seeing this image right now. And just, like I said earlier, how it plays with, you know, there's, like, some shots that are repeats from the first Spider-Man from 2002.
Yeah.
But again, it's playing into, like, how it's changed and, like, how this relationship's at between Peter and Mary Jane, Peter and Spider-Man, just all around, I think it's just such a smart film, and I just love watching it.
You know, I'll agree. I remember definitely being a kid, and of course, you know, doing what every kid does, and jumping off the couch and jumping on the beds and acting like I'm Spider-Man watching this movie. And you're right, Doc Ock is an amazing villain. Love Doc Ock so much. So, you know, I can agree. I mean, top five? Maybe
I mean, maybe not for you, but for me, I'm just...
But then again... We have very different top 5 and top 10 lists, so I can respect it without a doubt.
Honestly, just the way I remember it, I'll probably go home and watch it after this just to see it again.
Yeah.
I just think it's probably left the biggest impact on me. I know it's crazy to say, Peter, that's your number 5 film.
Yeah.
Don't worry, I'll say nice things about the 4th through 1.
Yeah.
But I think I just remember this film so vividly.
Yeah.
I honestly could talk about it for hours if I wanted to. But I think just for the context of where we're at right now... Yeah, 37 minutes in. You know what? I'll keep it there.
Fair enough.
I think it's a great film. You should check it out.
Check it out.
The definitive Spider-Man, unless Spider-Man Homecoming surprises.
Yeah.
And you'll see that review here on Real Talk.
You will see that review here on Real Talk.
Mr. Colin, what was your number 5?
My number 5 is Back to the Future Part 2 from 1989. I'm a huge fan of the Back to the Future franchise, but, you know, I guess my opinion's kind of unpopular because a lot of people say, you know, the original is the best. But I wholeheartedly disagree. And I think Back to the Future Part 2 is the absolute best Back to the Future film ever made. I think it's the most fun. I think it embraces that idea, this, like, retro, you know, high fantasy approach to what the future would be like. I feel like I love Marty McFly more in this movie. I love the angst. I love the conflict. I love the climax of the conflict and how it's resolved. I think it's just so much fun. And again, this is a movie I can literally watch any time of the day, never get tired of it. Yeah, I mean, it's a blast.
That's what I love about these, you know, personal top 10 lists. Like, you know, most people would, if you probably like do a definitive, like, objective list, you'd probably have to put Back to the Future on.
Yeah.
But again, I understand what you mean by, again, I think it did more with the idea of the future.
Yeah.
And again, I love retro future, you know, the idea of, like, what did this decade think the future would look like?
Exactly.
And you know what? Looking at that, I think that's what the people from the 80s would think what the future looks like.
And it's so weird because when we're talking about our top 10 list, it's like, how do you defend something that you love? Because it's completely opinion-based. So I know it sounds monotonous, but I'm like, yeah, this is just fun. I love it because I love it. There, and yeah, that's all you get.
The only slight thing that ever felt off to me was George's dad getting killed. Like, I was like, okay,
I can get that.
That's a little unnecessarily dark for this movie, but you know what? It makes up for it after just, like, I love the scene where Marty McFly has to avoid his path.
Yes, I love it so much.
It's just, it's so creative, and it's hard for a sequel to play with what the original did.
Yeah.
This is a sequel that legitimately is in the first movie.
Exactly.
But just like another crazy size, like, ooh, was this going on in the first movie? Like, time travel movies are weird because you start like opening up all these rifts, but
yeah,
I think, like we said, it works.
I know, and it revealed so many like quintessential, you know, 1980s, you know, fashion standards from the film, like Marty McFly's hat, his jacket, his air mags, you know, the hoverboard, all these different fun things that are so iconic now that it's just, it's one of those movies, it's always going to be on the top 10 list for me. It's one of those movies I can always watch over and over again. So from here, man, we're really getting into the nitty-gritty. Mm-hmm. So, Peter, I know what your number four is, and it's a great movie. What's your number four?
I'm not going to dwell on it too long, because I feel like I've talked about this in almost half the episodes we've done for
Real Talk. That's okay, though. That's what it's about.
But it's Halloween from 1978, John Carpenter's horror masterpiece.
It is a masterpiece.
Absolutely go on record and say that. What can I say about that I have not said before? Again, I love the character of the Shadow, which unfortunately became Michael Myers and was kind of ruined in the sequels, but yeah. That's fine. I don't have to acknowledge them.
Yeah.
They don't exist to me.
But you're right, this idea of like the shape, this villain that we don't know. And we've talked about this a lot. I know, kind of like you said, it's hard to say something we haven't already said about Halloween, because I know we both love Halloween so much. But there's so much beauty in not knowing the motives of the villain. And you don't know the motives of the
villain.
And that's
what always made it so terrible. And again, just the tone, the music especially. I know we've talked about this before, but that always needs to be highlighted. You know, just, it made the movie.
Oh, it's not a doubt.
I've actually seen, you know, edited versions where there's no music, because that's originally how Carpenter showed it to studios.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's so...
It doesn't work as much.
It kind of works in some sense, but it's just that the way they use the music made perfect sense.
You're right.
And especially, you know, how... Have you talked about Jaws yet?
Mm-mm.
Okay, well, let's be real. We know you. You're going to talk about Jaws eventually.
I will.
It has that Jaws effect where they use the music to show the monster is coming, and it builds up. It's like, oh boy, here it comes, and you're still jump by it. But every now and then, it wouldn't use the music.
Yeah.
Like, I remember the scene where Laurie Strode, you know, finally makes it back to the house. She's behind the couch, and the next thing you know, you just see Michael Myers come up. It's like, God, that's a good scene.
It is.
That's a good scene.
Because it just happens, and there's what I love about it. You don't need to know why it's happening.
No.
It just happens. And that's what makes it terrifying. And I think as a kid, that's why I was, and I'm still terrified by this, because kind of like we've talked about, it's very real. Mm-hmm. Like the thought of this, a masked murderer, you know, terrorizing a town for no apparent reason is a very real thing.
The mask design is great.
Yeah. Something just, so simple, but something so effective.
Just all around, I mean, technical aspect, story aspect, just all around, I think it works perfectly. And again, I will always say it's not a slasher film.
Yeah.
Because they use, you know, these kills artfully, I would say. Yeah. John Carpenter did. I mean, there's not too many of them.
Yeah.
I will never forget the scene where Michael Myers kills Bob, and he just, you know, stabs him on this wall and just takes a look, and just, you know, a wide shot back. It's just like, he just stares at him like, God, that's creepy.
I love it. It's so scary.
There's so many good scenes like that in this movie.
Yeah.
Again, I don't want to dwell too much on it, but I think it's perfect.
I agree.
That's why it's number four.
Yeah, agreed.
Mr. Kahn, was your number four Jaws?
It is. My number four is a 1975.
Called it.
Steven Spielberg masterpiece, Jaws. I can never say enough good things about Steven Spielberg, which you're about to hear a lot about him in my next few movies. I think Jaws is just one of the most incredible movies of all time. And as kind of what we've talked about in past episodes, it started this idea of summer blockbusters. It kind of built this legacy. Everything about it, the suspense. As we've talked about in the past, you know, the shark didn't work mm-hmm. more than half of the time. So what do? They're like, well, we have to make it scary. Mm-hmm. And the way we're going to make it scary is we're not going to show it that much. But when you do see the shark, we're going to make sure it's effective. And that's something that modern movies don't do, because what do you do? 15 minutes into a new movie that's supposed to be a suspense or a horror film, you see the monster. Mm-hmm. I mean, you don't see him for a few seconds. You see him for like a solid 4 minutes.
Honestly, some films open with the monster.
Exactly. And you become so desensitized where it's not scary anymore. That's the beauty of Jaws. They really play into the suspense, I think, better than any other film better than any other film since Hitchcock's classics, if I'm being completely honest. I think they play into that suspense. I love the characters from Jaws. I love the setting. Mm-hmm. I mean, Quint's monologue on the boat, I think is one of the, honestly, I will go on record and say, I think it's one of the best monologues in any film ever made. Yeah, you know what I'm talking about, right? The shark killer, you know, that's kind of his thing. I think that is one of the most incredible monologues of any movie. It's a movie that I'm actually probably going to watch this tonight. I was actually thinking about that a second ago. I'm going to go watch Jaws tonight. It's just so much fun. It's one of those movies I always get sucked in, and I can just watch it over and over and over again. And it's my boy Steven Spielberg. I mean, gosh, he's a genius. He was a young, young filmmaker at
this
time.
It's hard to hate Spielberg because he still puts effort into his movies.
He does.
And even as a young filmmaker,
I know.
You could tell he was destined for great things.
And you know what? People can say it's cliche that I love Spielberg so much, because I know people are going to say every one of his films is the same. He you know what? He does have a very, you know, distinctive collection of shots that he likes. But you know what? It always works. It always works in the end. I'm not going to mention what my next movie is yet, but you're going to hear more about Spielberg. But anyways, moving on to, I guess we're on number three now. Peter.
We're in the metal stages.
Oh, we're on the metal stages. Bronze. So, Peter, what is your number three film?
Probably the first film I remember just loving.
Yeah.
1999, Iron Giant.
That is a great movie.
Everything I have come to love before I even knew I would love it. The 50s aspect, Cold War, nuclear holocaust vibe going around. Science fiction, such a great thing. And it all comes, and it's animated.
Yeah.
And it's from a filmmaker I respect so much, Brad Bird.
Yep.
Just probably I would say his best film.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lie. I know people will probably say Incredibles. Like, no, I'm sorry. You're wrong.
Yeah.
Your opinion's wrong. I'm sorry.
The Iron Giant is a great movie. It used to terrify me as a kid.
Oh, it feel like it shouldn't have, but the way they made some of those early scenes where, you know, Hogarth meets the giant.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
It's scary.
It was. And again, I know you love animation, especially hand-drawn.
Yeah.
The style of this movie
it's so much fun.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And again, it just, Hogarth is one of my favorite characters ever. Just believe he's a believable kid in the 50s.
Yeah.
And just him getting this just giant robot, it works. I don't even know where to begin with this film. It's like Spider-Man 2 for me. It's like I can talk about it for hours. The script is great. You know, just how everything plays into one another.
Yeah.
Again, I love the whole vibe of, you know, the Cold War. Sputnik just launched. You know,
Peter loves the Cold War, folks.
Love the Cold War. Although Dr. Strangelove did not make this list somehow. Again, I love the atmosphere of Maine.
Yeah.
Especially how it's, you know, kind of fall and winter in this movie. Just all around. It's the first movie I feel like I remember I said, I love this movie.
Yeah.
Even before, I know I saw Star Wars before I saw this movie. I was just like, back to your Peter hates Star Wars genes. Like,
Peter hates Star Wars, guys.
I don't think I felt the same way I did about Star Wars the way I did Iron Giant early on in my life.
You know, you're just really making a bad case. You know, I'm not buying that you're a Star Wars fan.
Yeah, fair enough.
I mean, yeah, come on now. You talk a lot of crap about Star Wars, but that's okay.
It deserves it. But yeah, Iron Giant. Fantastic movie. If you've never seen it, see it and get ready to cry, because oh my god, that ending is perfect.
It's a roller coaster. It is. It's fun. I mean, it's a movie I can go back to.
The way they can make you feel almost human emotion for just this, you know, this giant robot.
I know.
Spoilers.
Yeah, spoilers. It's about a giant robot.
Giant robot. And again, what is it with Vin Diesel playing just these weird characters and making them perfect? Groot.
Yeah. I mean, what the heck?
I mean, his voice for the giant is believable.
Good for you, Vin Diesel. Come talk to us on the show. We're working on getting a lot of celebrities on the show. Spielberg's going to drop by. Vin Diesel, George Lucas is going to come by. We're going to have a lot of great celebrities.
They filmed Gone Girl in this town. This is a Hollywood pit.
I mean,
right
now. We're practically on a Hollywood backlot right now.
Exactly.
So I think Ben Affleck's going to drop by next week.
So yeah, that's all I can say about Iron Giant without making this episode go too long. But Colin, what is your bronze film?
My bronze film is the 1981 masterpiece, Raiders of the Lost Ark. Gosh, where do I even begin? I mean, I will go on record and say this, and this is like sacrilege to a lot of people, but I do like Indy. I think I like Indy more than I like Star Wars.
I do.
Isn't that's just like, to some people, those are fighting words, but I love Indiana Jones so much. I love Harrison Ford so much. I love Steven Spielberg so much. And when you put all those things together, it is one of my favorite adventure films of all time because it's so raw, it's gritty. And the thing is this, Harrison Ford, Indiana Jones, he's such a relatable guy. He's such a raw character, and he's just like an average dude. That's, you know, he's like, you know, let's go on an adventure. You know, let's go find the Ark of the Covenant. You know, let's do this.
You want to talk about getting two great filmmakers at their prime,
George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. Oh my gosh,
together on this, and oh my, it feels like what they would do if they had
exactly,
because, you know, when Lucas made Star Wars, his inspiration was always, you know, these old serials and, you know,
yeah,
the things that would play before the actual movie. And it's a celebration of early cinema and adventure, and it feels like it.
Yeah. I mean, I will honestly go on record and say, if my number one film was not what it is, for reasons that I'll discuss here in a bit, I honestly think that Raiders would be my number one favorite movie of all time.
I'm amazed it kind of isn't.
I know.
The way you talk about it.
It is. I mean, gosh, I love Raiders of the Lost Ark. I could talk about it for so long. But it's number three. It is only number three, and there's a couple reasons as to why it's number three. But, I mean, there's really not a lot to say about it. I mean, I feel like everyone listening, if you're listening to the show and you're still listening after 50 minutes, you've seen Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Oh,
let's come on.
Good for you people. 50 minutes.
50 minutes, I know. So, moving on to number two, man, Silver. Peter, what's your Silver?
There was part of me that wanted to make number one a tie.
Yeah.
But when I talk about my number one film, there was just no way it could be tied with this. I love this film. It's from one of my, probably my second favorite director, Sergio Leone.
Yeah.
And I probably haven't gotten this feeling yet. I love Westerns. Westerns are my favorite genre. I know I haven't had one yet, even on the best of the rest, but my second favorite film of all time is The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly.
Yep.
Perfect.
It is good.
It's bad
and it's ugly.
Oh, yeah. I honestly should just end there, but the characters of The Good, the Bad, the Ugly, I love how they all interact with each other. I love their scenes together. I love this story of a Western set. Of course, it's a spaghetti Western, so they filmed it in the desert sections of Italy.
Yeah.
But just the idea of like a Western set in the Civil War. It's a treasure hunt. It's betrayal after betrayal after alliance after alliance. It's a roller coaster of a film.
It is.
And it's one of those things like I can't ever see it something like this being made again from an original standpoint.
I can agree.
I think it's just one of those films that they made it and that's what you got. It's perfect.
Yeah.
It kind of is.
So I'm going to be completely honest with you and you're going to lose your mind, but I have never watched The Good and the Bad and the Ugly.
Let's be real. It's 3.5 hours long, and oh, it feels like
it. Feels
oh,
like it, right?
It feels a little longer at times. And there's technically two films you got to watch before. I mean, not to understand, but there are two films before in the series, the Man with No Name trilogy. But
this summer, we will sit down and we will like have pizza or something, some unhealthy food, which we love so much, and we will power through The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. Oh, just for you.
You should. You really should.
I will. I'm going to.
I think all of you should. But The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, if you don't like Westerns, watch this. And you'll start binge-watching Westerns like I have.
Yeah.
It ruined my life, and it should ruin yours, too.
Ruin lives together. The good, the bad, and the ugly.
That's my tagline for it.
Hey, it works, right?
Mr. Colin, got through that fast. Silver film.
My silver film? Gosh, I don't have enough good things to say about this. Richard Donner, 1985, as mentioned. It's The Goonies. Story by my boy Steven Spielberg. Go figure. I think this is the quintessential adventure film. As a kid, there is not a better... Honestly, I don't think there's a better film you could ask for than this. This ragtag group of kids, you know, in search for this treasure. They stumble upon a pirate ship. They're being chased by this evil family and the setting. Just, you know, the Pacific Northwest, Astoria, Oregon. I don't have enough good things to say about this. I mean, it's such a fun movie. And this is truly... Now, I know I've said this a lot. This is truly a movie I can watch over and over and over again and not get tired of it. I think The Goonies is just one of the most fun movies that's ever been made. And I technically speaking, I guess if you look on Rotten Tomatoes, I believe it has like a 70%. It's not incredibly high ranked. I mean, 70% is good, decent, you know. I mean, that's a C. But I don't think it gets enough credit. I really, truly don't, because I think it's one of the best adventure films.
It seems to get lost when you start talking about, because again, Spielberg has so many good movies that he's been involved with in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
But I totally agree with you because one of my favorite films I recently watched this week for the first time in probably a long, long time.
Yeah.
It's hard to see a film get, you know, the heroes and the villains and everybody else right.
Just right.
To make you involved in their stories.
Yeah.
And I think that's what this one does. I mean,
it does.
These kids are fun to watch. Chunk is my spirit animal. Sloth is the greatest. Sloth is probably the greatest character in film history.
He is incredible.
Next to RoboCop, of course.
Oh my gosh! Don't even get started on RoboCop again.
But just the crime family is fun to watch, and just, you know, everybody trying to get to this treasure. You know, of course, the heroes out in front, the villains close behind.
Yeah, it's so great because, like, the Fratellis, they're evil people, but at the same time, they're hilarious and they're just a big joke.
Oh yeah,
and it just works so well. And the music's incredible. And I tell you this, if you can sit there and watch the final scene of the Goonies when One-Eyed Willie's ship sails off into the distance and they're all sitting on the beach, and you don't get goosebumps, you are not a film buff. I can say that right now, because that moment of the movie is my favorite movie by far. And it's just like the culmination of everything they've worked for. One-Eyed Willie is free. His ship is sailing off into the distance. Gosh, it's so good. So good.
Can't agree more.
Yeah. So here we go. We are on the gold medal.
How long did it take us to get here, Colin?
Let's see. Let's check our time. 55 minutes and 50 seconds.
Well, my favorite film of all time is Friday the 13th. No, I'm kidding. It is from my boy Stanley Kubrick, 2001: A Space Odyssey.
Classic.
Can never watch this enough, mostly because I still have no idea what's going on.
That's the beauty of 2001. You never know what's going on.
But it's always fun to go back to it and get, like, Good, Bad, and the Ugly. Oh, it feels long. Mm-hmm. It feels long.
Yeah.
Like that last 10-minute sequence, it does not feel like 10 minutes, I'll tell you that much. But that's what I love about it. I mean, yeah. Everyone likes to say Star Wars is, you know, it pushed special effects very far. It did. It absolutely did.
Yeah.
It's a film that
practical effects,
kind of wanted me at one point to get into practical filmmaking before I realized, oh, it's all computers now.
Yeah.
Not doing that.
Not as much fun.
Honestly, almost a decade earlier, 2001 had some of the most elaborate effects.
Oh, without a doubt.
I mean, the scene with the pencil just floating is still much more. I'm not going to lie. It's kind of more impressive to me than anything Force Awakens did.
Yeah.
From its CGI standpoint. I mean, the amount of effort Kubrick put into this film, and Kubrick's strength is he's creative.
Yeah.
He knows how to tell stories and characters, and this is the best film to showcase that. Because he basically had free reign. Like, he could do whatever he wanted on this film, and it shows in a good way.
So let me get this straight real quick. So you think the pencil scene from 2001: A Space Odyssey is better than Kylo Ren holding the blaster bullet from Force Awakens?
Yes, I do.
Okay, fair enough. Carry on. just clarifying.
I hate Star Wars.
Anyways, carry on.
HAL 9000 is one of the greatest things from film ever. I mean, the way they tell his story, because here's the thing about artificial intelligence, stuff like that in film. It can go south really fast.
Absolutely.
And this is a film that made it believable. In the modern era, it's a cliche story of like, oh, the robot, artificial intelligence represented, you know, its mission in life, to, you know, make the mission go unhindered. It's like, so we got to kill the human beings. But again, here, it worked because it's the first time really it was ever seen in film.
Yeah.
But again, the way they build up to it, that's what most films lose. They just like go straight like, oh, it's a robot. People understand. Like, no, they get into this relationship. And one of my favorite scenes in that movie is at the end where there's that role reversal.
Yes.
Where Hal is always, you know.
Oh, that is great.
Just the cold, calculating robot. And as, you know, he's being dismantled by, you know, he becomes, it's so good.
It is so good.
And just, again, that ending is mind-blowing.
It really is. And Hal's voice is scary, too.
It is.
So creepy. That's what my dad and I were talking about. That he's like, yeah, it used to always creep me out. It's so good. I mean, it really, truly is. And as some may consider this film a quote-unquote pretentious film. I mean, I get it. You have to really be into movies to be able to respect it. Because like you said, you can watch it over and over and over again and take away a different meaning. 2001 A Space Odyssey is a lot to handle in one sitting.
It is.
It is a lot to handle.
Especially your first time if you like never actually cared about film as a hardcore art.
Yeah. And I think that's what makes it great. And I think that's why it absolutely deserves your number one spot.
Absolutely.
It definitely does.
The way it, you know, opens with just like, you know, this, you know, the beginning of time, the shot of the bone going up, and you see the spaceship emerge.
Oh, I know.
And just the end with the star shot. Oh, I love this film.
It is great.
I love this film.
It is great.
I can never get enough of it.
I just bought a copy of that.
Good for you.
I need to watch it.
Mr. Colin?
I'd watch it tonight if I wasn't going to watch Jaws, but anyways.
Got a lot of movies to watch after this.
We do have a lot of movies to watch.
Mr. Colin, you're going to end this with your favorite film of all time.
My favorite film of all time. Let's see here.
Tuesday, May 16th, just about 2 p.m.
You know, I will say my top 10 list changes often, but this has been my number one favorite movie of all time since I was a little kid, and it has truly remained my favorite movie of all time. I have so many fond memories of sitting on my grandparents' bed, watching this movie, being terrified, falling in love. I mean, this movie is what made me fall in love with the performing arts, made me want to perform, made me perform, made me fall in love with filmmaking and cinema as a whole. It's the 1939 Victor Fleming Wizard of Oz. The Wizard of Oz is just, I think, is truly one of the most amazing cinematic masterpieces ever made. And a lot of people may say it is a movie musical. How can you say that it's one of the best movies ever made? And I get that. I get what people are saying. But, and I'm not even talking from a Technicolor standpoint. I'm leaving that out entirely. I can't even articulate what I want to say right now. I just think it's one of the most incredible movies of all time. It's one of the most fun adventures with some of the most recognizable music. And I'm a huge musical buff. Anyone who knows me knows that I love musicals. I absolutely adore musicals. And I think this is one, just one of the best of all time. Judy Garland, oh my gosh, Ray Bolger. I mean, just so many incredible performers. And I love Victor Fleming. I think he does incredible work, and he can tell stories so well. And everything about this movie is just incredible. I mean, Margaret Hamilton. I mean, oh my gosh, just this all-star, you know, lineup of people. But the use of physical sets. Just think about that. How massive the sets were for this film. You know, you can't rely on all this computer-generated imagery. This is all practical effects. This is 1939. I mean, this is crazy. This is 11 years after Mickey Mouse is created. That's a long time ago. People, it's like you can show this to kids or show this to, say, young adults, and they can't really conceptualize how old this movie is. And what they were able to accomplish at this time is just simply mind-blowing. I mean, from using pantyhose to create a tornado at the beginning, so many incredible things, to putting, you know, Jell-O on a horse for the horse of a different color. It's just, gosh, it's so much fun. I don't even know what else to say. I can always, always, always come back to The Wizard of Oz. I have so many fond memories of this movie.
I agree. It's probably the most cliched pick.
Exactly.
No offense to you. It's probably the most cliched pick, but again, it's understandable because that's a film that most people don't realize. It means a lot to cinema.
It does.
I mean, 1939, Technicolor, something on that scale to be worthwhile to see and profitable. Yeah. I mean, that's...
And that's what I hate, because when you say that, people are like, oh, come on, The Wizard of Oz... They say exactly that. That's the most cliche pick you can have. But it's so much more than the fact that it's an AFI Top 100 film. It just means so much to me and shaped who I am today, and my love for the arts and my love for, you know, for movies and my love for music. It just shaped everything, and just the fond memories that I have associated with The Wizard of Oz. I admittedly judge people so hard if they've never seen The Wizard of Oz or if they don't like it. I know that sounds so awful, but if you are 23 and you've never seen The Wizard of Oz, you have a lot of stuff to think about in life.
You have wasted your life.
Because, really, as a kid, this is probably one of the first movies I can honestly ever remember watching. I mean, I can say that without a doubt in my mind. This is one of the first movies I can ever remember watching. And growing up, my grandpa always called it The Wizard. He would never say, call it The Wizard of Oz. He'd always ask, do you want to watch The Wizard? And I'd be like, well, of course I want to watch The Wizard. So I'd sit on his bed and we'd watch The Wizard, and I would be scared to death during the tornado, and I'd be scared to death of the Wicked Witch. And then at the very end, it all works out.
It's probably the most classic film I think we've talked about today.
It is, no doubt about it.
And it's one of those films I think is, of all the films I think we've talked about, I think that's probably one of the more likely ones that will exist forever in some way, shape, or
exactly,
form.
Exactly, because it almost has to. And, you know, some more Best of the Rest films I love and I didn't mention. You know, I mentioned Singing in the Rain, but I love An American in Paris. And I mean, you know, Gone with the Wind, all these classic movies, Casablanca. And I didn't put them on my top 10. Mm-hmm. Although, I just don't want to seem like this pretentious movie guy, because I do love all of those old movie musicals so much. And I could very easily have filled my entire top 10 with movies from movie musicals from the 30s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. But I didn't. But I knew that The Wizard of Oz had to be number one. It's the only movie that will never change on my top 10 list. It will absolutely never leave the number one spot, ever.
I'm kind of with you. My number one and two are probably, and three are set forever.
Exactly.
I can't, I, Probably should have mentioned Terminator 2, Judgment Day, and my best of the rest again.
Fair enough.
God, I love Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I was going to say, Peter, we know you love Arnold.
Oh, he's a good man.
Peter wants Arnold Schwarzenegger to run for president.
I do. I know he can't legally, but you know what? I don't care at this point.
He doesn't care. You know, anything can happen, yeah. Right? Man, this has been fun. I mean, we're 1 hour and 5 minutes in. If anyone is still listening,
boy.
Thank you. I mean, there are so many things what can we encourage? Listen to Real Talk while you're mowing your yard. What is it? It takes like 1 hour to mow your yard,
basically,
right? Yeah. Just listen to it. And you can just listen to the whole episode.
Join us next time for 20 through 11.
We're going to be doing 20 through 11. And then a week after that, we're going to do our top 100 nonstop. So our episode should be about 27 hours long. So just be sure to tune into that one.
I don't even think this system would handle that.
Exactly. But yeah, this was fun. And as we said, I think we should maybe revisit this episode maybe 6 months. Do another, and honestly, I would love to not even look at what we've, listen to what we've recorded here.
Oh, I agree.
Redo our top 10 and see if it stays the same or see if it changes. One thing I can guarantee, Wizard of Oz is still going to be number one. And one thing I can guarantee you with Peter, 2001 A Space Odyssey is still going to remain number one.
Pretty much.
Yeah. Do you have anything else to say? This has been fun.
Basically, in review, I guess I hate Star Wars.
Peter hates Star Wars. I love Wizard of Oz. He loves cliche space movies. I'm just kidding. Mm-hmm. No.
I'll say 2001 is
the least cliche movie of all
the
time.
The least cliched film you could make joke about. It's like, you got to have some believability there.
No doubt.
Well, I
think that wraps it up.
Pull the plug. Just
pull the plug. Folks, as always, check us out on iTunes, the Google Play Store, KRCU.org. And as always, get on Facebook, type in KRCU, like the Facebook page. You can not only keep up with us and what we're doing, which we have a lot of fun stuff coming at you this summer that you're not going to want to miss. But you can also keep up with what's going on at KRCU as a whole. You know, we have a lot of great content here, a lot of great local content that you don't want to miss. So check that out. And yeah, thanks for tuning in, right?
That's all we can say at this point.
Is that all we can say?
An hour, 5 minutes in.
That's right. So for Real Talk, I'm Colin Ritter.
I'm Peter Lewis.
We'll see you at the movies.